The following message was recorded at an event hosted by Desiring God. More information about Desiring God events, conferences, and resources is available at www.desiringgod.org.
That last little comment about the Baptist General Conference being responsive to our concern is more due to John Piper's influence than to mine, I'm sure. But it is remarkable that there is no other denomination on the face of the earth, so far as I know, whose official declarations of purpose include in such explicit language the unreached peoples and the finishing of the task. And that's when the colored brochure that I'm sure many of you have seen if you're in BGC churches came out announcing that program, we mustered 45 people to help us stuff those into our outgoing bulletin. Just for fun, how many of you get our Mission Frontiers bulletin? Well, any of you who would like to get it, just put your name on a little slip of paper on that table where this literature comes from. I should have brought a copy for everybody. I forgot to. And we'll be glad to put you on it. In any case, we got 45 people. Now, how long do you think it took it, 45 people stuffing in colored brochures as this was going out into the mail? It took us 8 hours to stuff 75,000 of these bulletins. But we've never done that before. But we would be willing to do it if any other denomination declared as its central purpose the completion of the task. We were just singing, Thy Kingdom Come, same thing. It's what we pray in the Lord's Prayer is essentially the purpose of the Baptist General Conference denomination. And John was the one that made that link. In fact, it's the linking of missions and other subjects here at these annual conferences that's so fascinating. I'm sure that many of you, when you read the program, said, oh, there goes John again. He's always getting missions in there someplace, even if it doesn't have any relationship at all. And I have to say that this year's topic, well, put it this way. I feel, and I don't know how to explain this, but this is what came to me. I feel more comfortable with the atmosphere of this place, the supremacy of God and His purposes and all of that, than I do with the subject of this conference. And I'm sure there's a connection between the two, and I think John has portrayed that in the last hour. We're dealing with surface problems when the deep reality is God and what He's up to. And missions can't be another subject. It can't be a separate subject, obviously, when we talk about God and His purposes. So I'm very delighted to be here, and I don't know exactly. I've never been more unprepared, actually, for a talk, I don't think. And you had a little bit of inductive presentation in the last hour. This is going to be very inductive. I have been unable, actually, to bring into focus the hunch that I have, the intuition that I have, that I think that would be most relevant to this subject. So maybe you can help me. I can't even probably efficiently or effectively explain exactly where I'm coming from. If I could, then I would be able to get this topic in hand. I've lived in two worlds. I've lived in a primitive society, as some people call them, a language so different from English that Spanish is a mere dialect of English by comparison. And my background in anthropology introduced me to some extent in advance to such radically dissimilar societies. And I've tried to understand each of those two worlds. I haven't fully drawn all the conclusions that you ought to be able to. And I'm still working on that, so maybe you can help me. In another analogy, instead of speaking of two worlds, my role in the last 25 years or so has been in the military, the Christian military. I don't like military analogies, but They have some value. The civilian force, the mayors of the towns, they're the pastors in this analogy. The missionaries are the armed forces that go out across the world and tear families apart and leave behind people and friends and acquaintances, and they're not supposed to be normal ventures. They're emergency activities. They're redemptive activities rather than maintenance activities. But in a real war, now we haven't had any real wars since the Second World War. All these other wars have been little sideline pastimes by comparison. In a real war, there is no way to distinguish between the mayors of the towns and the generals on the front line. There's a continuous involvement from the tiniest little town to the most specific military objective, a continuous flow of personnel. I remember, I'm sure many of you, most of you, do not remember what I remember about the Second World War, because I'm much older, but they used to say, don't you know there's a war on, meaning you shouldn't be wasteful of this or that. Every automobile had a sticker on the window that prescribed to the gas station how much gasoline you should buy. You weren't supposed to get more than you were due. And there are other terrible hardships for the civilians, like being unable to buy nylon stockings because they were using that kind of thing for parachute cords. And coffee was in very short supply. So you can see the suffering of the citizens during a real war. But, of course, the real suffering was the separation. Missionary effort involves separation. It's not a normal thing for people to go out on their own, even in the fellowship with other people, and leave their families, their homes, their home churches. This is an unusual, unnatural, in some ways, it's the greatest sacrifice. It isn't the heat or the mosquitoes or the snakes or whatever. It's the absence, the separation, that's the greatest missionary burden. Well, now, I have not got my manuscript all written out, but I have some parts of it. Over the years, this is a one-page thing here, so it won't bore you too much. This forum has helpfully illuminated a number of key themes. Leave it to John Piper to ferret out the connection to the missionary movement of any and every subject which will come up. I've mentioned this. But there's always a connection, and this year is no exception. No mission agency today is unaware of the increasing baggage of unresolved problems which contemporary missionary candidates are bringing with them to the global mission task. I am grateful to be able to build on the insights of a number of mission agency leaders who have shared with me about this problem. I have a whole sheaf of stuff. However, I hasten to add, I'm not going to be talking about missions very much. The introduction almost covers the field. I will be attempting to focus on the monumental problem this conference has been dealing with, simply utilizing some of the additional data and insights which are available cross-culturally from missionary experience and mission leaders. In approaching a number of mission agencies about this theme, my own impressions have been confirmed. There is unquestionably an absolute difference, not just a relative difference, between the maturity and stability of missionary candidates a generation ago and those which are showing up at the doors of the mission agencies today. This is parallel to the fact that there is an absolute difference between the divorce rate 40 years ago and now. Then, one out of four marriages in general broke up, but only one out of 50 church-going couples broke up 40 years ago. One out of 50. Today, if today has suddenly come upon us, we would be absolutely and totally traumatized by the incredible change for the worse, despite the ocean of self-help and recovery literature, which is more of a symptom than actually a cure. The framers of this conference turned a neat phrase in speaking of the problem of finishing the task with unfinished people, but they did not intend by this metaphor to define the problem completely. You can contrast a well-built but poorly finished building, which only needs completion, to a poorly built building, which almost has to be torn down and rebuilt in order to be finished. One requires a lot more finishing, if you will, than the other. So in other words, the metaphor of finishing isn't all that useful. So I would like to approach this whole subject of unfinished people, whether they're the one kind or the other, from the unusual view of the American family as it is seen from the standpoint of non-Western society. This involves a drastic and unusual thesis. I'm going to proceed not on the assumption that American candidates for missionary service need further finishing, either before going or or after arriving, in order to be capable of handling the job required in cross-cultural mission service, but that the problem of their inadequacy, this is my thesis, cannot even be best understood unless it is looked at from outside our society, outside our culture, unless we are able to learn something profoundly important from the mission field. I have long believed that God has put us into missionary endeavors not merely to be a blessing to the peoples of the world, which is the obvious biblical mandate for mission, but he has sent us also to receive. No, I'm not about to plunge into the whole question of dialogue with other religions and all the wonderful things we can learn from them. I merely believe that as the gospel penetrates the world's kaleidoscope of peoples, each people, as it comes to the Bible, sees it with new and different insight, and that as a symphony orchestra that was disbanded and scattered all around and finally brought back piece by piece, the overall music would be more beautiful and wonderful as every new voice was added to that, or instrument was added to that orchestra. So missionaries are in the business of reestablishing the comprehensive diversity of God's creation, not simply trying to teach everyone to speak English and to be Americans and to wear ties and, you know, have aisles down the middle. We're out there to help those people become who God intended them to be, and then to learn from them as a global family of Christian believers. In other words, I'm saying we need to learn from the believers, not from the unbelievers, although we could learn something from the unbelievers as well, as you might see in a moment. Is it not obvious, for example, that rural agricultural societies might readily help gain for us the pungency of some of the agricultural parables? That's a rather superficial example. However, I have not very long believed that there is something else we can receive back from our mission endeavors around the world, something that does not come so much from the Christians or from some other religious tradition, but something that comes from comparing notes about things that are so basic that cultural and religious differences are not all that important. Things like breastfeeding. Is that a culturally developed invention, or is it something more basic? I say this despite the widespread disapproval of our own society's medicine men for many years. The fact that 200 million Americans could go headlong in the wrong direction for 30 years without any insight gained from the rest of the world, Christian or not, tells us the sad story that many of the American problems, those we're talking about here, will not so easily be solved unless we are willing to take note of the experience of humankind all around the world. And this is something to which our missionaries can introduce us. Specifically, the very nature of the unfinishedness of our contemporary mission candidates is something which it may well be that our own society does not have the resources to appraise clearly. What is it that I'm getting at? What is it about the American family I'm hinting at, which is visible to people from other lands, but which is invisible to us, and accounts for a great deal of the kind of unfinished candidates that are putting a great strain on mission boards today? Now, that's just an introductory statement. I'm going to go into this somewhat inductively. I'd like to read from an article in the LA Times magazine, which is on January 19th. Something is at work here at the Intermountain home. This is in Helena, Montana. You can feel it. The children have stopped kicking each other. They don't set fires. They don't abuse animals anymore. They don't sexualize each other. They don't throw knives. But that's not the magic. The magic is that you see the children when they come in like wild animals. But in 6 months, they're children. They look like children. They feel like children. They have fun. They giggle. They laugh. This is the last paragraph of a long article. 50% of the children who come to hospitals and to residential treatment centers, now this is talking about other institutions, could benefit from longer stays. But it costs $73,000 a year to keep a child, even at this Intermountain home. By comparison, it costs four times as much to five times as much to treat an abused child in a full-time hospital. And it costs from $400 to $500 a day, which is about half again as much, for a residential treatment center in the L.A. area. Long-term, scientifically solid studies are rarely conducted by any program in terms of helping children because they are expensive and difficult. Many of the families whose children are treated move frequently. Privacy laws rule out long-term studies. The real question, of course, is whether this kind of intensive therapy, which clearly works on a small scale, the Intermountain home that I referred to actually has taken its techniques from a Colorado, evergreen Colorado home called the Forest Hills something or other. So there's two of them. But the question is, can you apply this therapy on a larger scale? Now, these are comments at the very end of the article. Let me read a phrase or two from the beginning of the article, if I can find it here. They use an innovative long-term program for treating severely abused children. This home in the isolated mountain ring city of Helena, Montana, is often a last chance stop for children who, like Brian, who's one of the kids talked about here, have been brutalized by adults until their minds have snapped. In the aftermath of neglect, sexual abuse, and even physical torture, they face a raft of problems, including psychoses and post-traumatic stress disorder, and afflictions suffered by Vietnam veterans haunted by the horrors of war. These children can be savagely violent, emotionless, sexual molesters of other children, fire starters. There is evidence indicating that such children, untreated, are likely to become the most brutal of criminals. The Ted Bundys, the Dahmers, the Richard Specks of the next generation. Well, in this treatment center, the normal thing it says, if a child, this is the Skinner approach, if a child behaves well, he's rewarded. If his behavior is unacceptable, he may be banished. Eventually, the child learns what is acceptable and what isn't acceptable. There are a few alternatives to this approach, and if it fails, they're speaking of all the places across the country where children are dealt with, if it fails, there's little recourse but to keep the child in an institution for the rest of his life, for his protection, for the protection of other people. The Intermountain Home and the program it's modeled on, that of Forest Heights Lodge in Evergreen, Colorado, claim success with a far different program, one that showers abused children with a constant and consistent nurturing that they never got from their parents. Their goal is to allow them for the first time in their lives to develop a strong bond with another person. What a novel idea. Thus, they are not corrected so much as accepted. This treatment is based on the attachment model. Here's a brand new idea, attachment between children and adults. The principles of which were noted in mid-century by a psychoanalyst and developed by somebody else and so forth and so on. So they're really making progress. Well, no one comes out right out and says so, but the basis for the treatment is the closest thing to family-style love that an institution can create. An embarrassing admission, because, you know, that's rather pedantic, simple, and, you know, it's embarrassingly simple for technical people. Our program is really just common sense. That's what good parenting is about. We've rediscovered what grandma knew. Have to go that far back. There's so much research and science on children that something has been forgotten. Kids need to be touched, need to be hugged, need to be nurtured. They need to feel loved and feel worthwhile. What an incredible insight. You know, it just staggers your imagination that something like this would be printed in the LA Times. There is no universally accepted roadmap to how a child develops, but the attachment model has gained credence since the 50s. In a nutshell, it says that the first months of a child's life are critical to well-being, more so than science ever imagined. For it's in those early months that children build their first emotional and psychological bridges to the outside world with the critical help of a nurturing caregiver, father, mother, or someone else. The quality of their lives will depend on those bridges. The early part of the attachment process works like this. Now they're going to explain something that, of course, no one would ever know otherwise unless they read it in the LA Times. Babies get hungry, wet their diapers. They cry and scream, kick their legs, wave their arms, and tension builds until a parent answers. Some of our most recent evangelical books say just tell that kid to go jump in the lake so he's not going to start dominating the parent. The child is given a breast, cradled. The diaper is changed. The mother sings to baby softly. The mother and the child come down from the stressful peak together, relaxing and comforting each other. As children get older, they begin to explore the world, to take in new experiences and people. But always, if the attachment process was a healthy one, with a knowledge of a secure home base to return to. The baby has, see, this is something that a counselor cannot provide, notice. And in fact, a pastor can't provide, notice. And the average church does not provide, notice. As children get older, they begin to, the baby has been taught the rudiments of human relationships that other people can be trusted to soothe, nurture, and care. Indispensable psychological nutrients, apparently, you know, science has told us this, for human development. But if emotionally crippled parents respond to children's crying with neglect or violence, whether they learned it in a seminar at my home church, or just were disposed that way, the children can begin to numb out, to actually stop feeling pain and to stop expressing needs, both physical and emotional. They never develop basic skills for bonding and cannot bond in a healthy way to others. This is William Cooper's experience. He could not bond. They have been taught that there is no one for them to depend on, so they will never trust. Each child in this home situation that's been constructed artificially, but very effectively, each child has an attachment figure, one counselor with whom he or she has chosen to build the kind of relationship a daughter or son should have formed with parents. Once the child gravitates toward a counselor, that counselor begins taking on the role of a parent. What a brilliant idea. Holding the child, giving a bottle, getting the child up for school, going to special events. This is the attachment theory in essence and the centerpiece of treatment at these two institutions. Each child must build a strong bond with a counselor. And then here's a professional observation. Yet staff members mustn't get too close. They mustn't get too involved so that they begin to lose their professional distance. And of course, this doesn't go on forever. A cornerstone of the treatment is the extremely long stay in a residential setting, which allows the intense feelings and emotions that bond human beings to come into play. Foster parent programs often make things worse for abused children because they move children around and break the attachments they form again and again and again. And then children are afraid to form them because they know they're just going to be broken again. It's naive to assume that the most pregnant therapeutic moment is in a counseling hour in an office. We give too much credence to therapy and not enough to how we live. What changes people's... Well, remember Larry saying last night how he was so proud of this brilliant advice he gave to this fellow that really gave him a new insight and so forth. And later he saw him and the fellow remembered not that, but the conversation out in the grass. What changes people's lives are the people they live with. Well, enough for this article. I thought it would be interesting, the rediscovery of the family, so to speak, or at least of a somewhat bizarre partial reconstruction of the family there, as a prelude to making some comments about how very, very different the American family is when viewed from other parts of the world. And I don't think the average person in this country is prepared for insights along this line. This is where I struggle the most. I don't know exactly how to explain myself and so forth. A seminary student at Fuller once came down to Guatemala. I met him for the first time after he was there for 3 or 4 months. I said to him, what is the most surprising thing? You know, you were looking forward to coming down. You read books on Guatemala. You knew a lot about Guatemala. What was the most astonishing thing after coming here to Guatemala? And I don't think I would have ever guessed, not because I didn't know what he was going to say, know the situation in which he described, but I didn't somehow put the two together. He started speaking in breathless tones about this church he went to the young people's meeting on a Sunday night, and how in this little group of 25 or 30 people there, there weren't just a certain age, but there was a lot of different young people from maybe about 4 or 5 to 16 or 17 or 18, which, of course, is not the way we couldn't handle that because we're stratified. I mean, sixth graders will not talk to fifth graders, you know. We've been trained. But he said, and then he went on, he said, you know, there were 15-year-olds there bouncing kids on their knees. They weren't even their own siblings. And he went on and on. He was just so staggered. How did they do that? Where did that come from? You know what? That isn't even a part of their Presbyterian heritage down there. They were doing that not because it came out of some Presbyterian literature through the mission board. They were doing that because in Guatemala, they have families. They have families in Guatemala. If you've never seen one, you could go and see one. You'd be surprised at what a family is. Now, things that happen suddenly get in the paper. Even good things that happen suddenly, but usually bad things that happen suddenly. Things that happen gradually don't get in the paper, are not even noticed, and it's almost impossible for a society, for the consciousness of a society, to take seriously gradual changes, for the worse or for the better. We just accept them eventually. And this is why it's so difficult for me now to proceed, because We accept industrialization. We accept urbanization. We accept our school system. We accept postponed marriage. These things are invisible to the fish that swim in this kind of water. Anybody who would question the impact of industrialization right down to this moment on the family or urbanization, on churches where no one really knows each other very well, or the schooling process, which separates children for many, many hours for most of the hours of contact that they might otherwise have. You can't question things that are so well entrenched, that have become so part and parcel of our society. I just throw that out as a warning, because it's hard for us. I'm sure that I could stand up here and make a few statements that would sound very radical if I didn't watch out. Even if I did watch out. The boarding schools of England, were the truth ever known? You know, like John said at the end of his gospel, the whole world could not contain the pages of anguish and agony that you could find in the boarding schools of England down through history. Or maybe in the mission field. I remember I didn't have any kind of a negative attitude toward the missionary boarding school in Guatemala. At the time, a tourist wanted me to take him up in that neck of the woods, which I'd never been before. So I went up there and let the man and his wife out to go in and see some folks who were part of the administration of the school. And I was standing outside the door. It was a great big corrugated iron door, you know, made out of the kind of roofing corrugated stuff, you know. There was about a 3-inch crack. And I saw a little kid sticking his nose through there and looking out. And I was watching other things. First thing you know, he got out the door. I don't think this was supposed to happen. That door should have been shut. But he got out the door, and I remember to this day, he was so short that he put his arm around me, not me, but just one of my legs. He wasn't a teenager. He was 6 or 7 years old. He looked up at me and he said, "Are you my daddy?" In that school, parents are not allowed to visit because, as the people who run the school put it, they're more trouble than the children. It's only when the parents visit that we have trouble with the children. So let's just not have the parents come during the school year. If there's a birthday that happens to occur during the school year, they make that allowance. Well, now, it turned out that that school was full. Our children were unable to go there. Maybe it's for the best. We started a school where they could go and come back every day. This second missionary kids school wasn't just for missionary kids, but for Guatemalan kids. It's a big school today. So we escaped that experience. Now, I'm not saying that all boarding schools are evil or anything. I'm just saying that we perhaps are unaware of things that are an accepted pattern in our society and what they do to us. But you know, the fragmentization of our society, the spreading out not only of the family into different jobs, the mother, the father, the children, into different schools, but then what happens when school becomes so prominent a feature of an industrialized society so that we don't have to bother with teaching young kids to be helpful? In Guatemala, families work together. There are ingenious techniques for helping the children of the family feel important and participate. And I must confess that when those children are really little, it's more trouble than it's worth. The little girls follow after the mothers with little bottles on their heads, because older women carry bottles and other things. They really use their heads. But these little girls, they're always falling off, and the mother's having to stop and help them and so forth. But when they get a little older, they carry a bit of a payload in those bottles, along with the mother. And when they get to be 10 or 11, 12, 13, they are really helpful. And the little boys go with the fathers to chop wood. Wood is the source of heat and cooking and so forth. And the splinters fly all over the place. Just what a little kid can deal with, picking up those things and stacking them up. And when the father's on his way to come home, why, the little boy has a little bundle. And bigger boys have bigger bundles, and they follow along, and they're doing what their fathers are doing. They're very proud of what they're doing. In fact, a World Vision article recently, 6 or 7 months ago, is a lurid, you know, just crocodile tear report of child labor conditions around the world and how the world is enslaving the poor children while, of course, we're liberating them and stuffing them in schools. But the article ends with this very, very, the pathos of this final comment. It just bleeds through the page. He says, the worst, most insoluble dimension of this problem is that the children often love what they're doing. You can't get them away. They'd rather do that. Our children coming up through Mexico, we never worked overseas. We just went down the coast to Guatemala. We used to drive back and forth. We had a one-month vacation every year. How do you like that for luxury? And it took us 73 hours to get home. We put our kids in school so they knew their classmates from the previous year and so forth. And well, anyway, coming up, our kids, four daughters, pretty close together, were mainly younger in the earlier years, and we really had a job trying to keep them amused while Roberta and I traded off driving 24 hours a day. And so we would go down to the capital city, where this was not available in our part of the country, and buy crayons and color books and comic books and stack them away. And each day we would ladle out one more, maybe twice a day, one more new thing for them to, you know. Well, when you drive constantly, you know, you do have to stop for, you know, rest stops and stuff. And along one of these bleak northern Mexican roads one time, we were stopped and getting back in the car. And what did we see? These precious crayons, which we had purchased for their enjoyment. They had found a couple of beer cans along the side of the road and were grinding the crayons up the way the little kids in Guatemala would grind corn, because our kids had already learned how to grind corn. The little girls, and ours were all girls, would be given these little stones just their size, and they could actually grind. Now, they weren't much help in the earlier years, but they were helping. They sensed a continuity of responsibility. They didn't come home from school and have someone look at the pictures they'd drawn for which there was no earthly value and pretend like this was great and pin it up for a few months or something. They knew what they were doing was valuable. They never eventually saw those things in the wastebasket because they were participating in a significant fashion. And there was no adolescence in that society. I'm not trying to glorify the Indian or anything like that. I'm just saying they did things differently. It would take an excursion to sense the difference. Here's another shocking example. I was in Singapore three or four times in a two-year period, and that's a very amazing and marvelous city. One of the things I like most about it is on every taxi cab across the windshield, you know, where you have this little bluish area to cut out the sun, there's a little statement that says, towards a non-smoking Singapore by the year 2000. They're going to banish that drug. They banish other drugs, too. You know, it's rather horrendous what they do to people who come through the airport with drugs. They do not leave Singapore. They do not survive. Singapore is a very, very orderly country. My daughter lived there for a year, one of my daughters, and going down the street, her baby was very, very well endowed compared to the other babies, and the Chinese mothers would ask her, well, what kind of formula do you use? Everybody in Singapore uses formula. My daughter couldn't even explain clearly how she uses her own breast milk, because that's not done in Singapore. Singaporeans are very progressive. It's the only country in the world where everyone speaks English and uses chopsticks. They are very Chinese in some ways. They are very Western in others. And there's a question mark arising more and more prominently as to whether this Westernization is all to the good. And, you know, I could tell them lots of things wrong with the Western society. That wouldn't be any problem. But I could not have anticipated what they saw to be the problem. Here's a newspaper, secular paper. Reading the paper, it says, is talking about the Oscar ceremony. This is about 2 or 3 years ago. You know, 2 or 3 hours, and all these gorgeous people come up there and receive these Oscars and other awards and stuff. And the paper remarks about the fact that every single person spoke humbly and gratefully for somebody else who, you know, it wasn't me, it was the supporting actor, it was my director, it was my somebody else, or the script writer. You know, this was a great story, no one could have wrecked it, and that's why, you know, there was this, all this fake modesty, which is so marvelous in our eyes in American society. It's a grace in a way. But the paper went on with just breathless tones. Nobody in 3 hours was ever grateful to their parents. I wouldn't have thought of that. I wouldn't have missed it. It's not American. It went on to talk about the school books. And I could tell you, we all know what's wrong with the school books and stuff like that. So here I am reading Dick and Jane and the dog and the teacher and the garbage man and so forth and so forth. What are they going to say about the school books? There are no parents in the school books. Now, this is a national, see, it's a small country. This is a national, almost a phobia. And I have to admit, it's a worthy phobia. These two things would have never even caught my attention. I had to go over there and look back, look through their eyes to even see the degree to which our society has lost it, really lost it, in certain key areas. We've lost a sense of authority in the family to an extent that we don't realize. In the church, even. I remember the first time I was so staggered being in an Indian church situation north of Mexico City, 50 miles, a town of, you know, a kind of a rambunctious industrialized town of about 100,000 people. Up in the mountain, next across the highway there, is a very precipitous little hill where an Indian tribe has huddled and sought refuge, the Otomi. Now, these are all evangelical believers. The pastor, Venancio, found a Bible, a Spanish Bible, by the way, and became a follower of Christ, and was, along with a few of his followers, then thrown out, just rejected by the tribal group. And they found the only land that no one wanted, which was that precipitous little hill. They built their homes on the edges of that steep rising hill. And gradually more and more were bailed out of the pagan tribe into this Christian tribe. And, well, never mind. And these people now are very highly trusted down in the city of Ixmiquilpan. They're the carpenters and the bricklayers and the electrical workers who are absolutely trusted. It's a phenomenon. But the thing that arrested my attention was, I don't know how I happened to hear this, but Venancio goes around to each home once a month and checks up to see if they're clean and orderly. I don't know if that's a reasonable thing for an American pastor to do. I can't imagine that happening in America. I was shocked. What right does he have to invade people's privacy? I mean, this is as bad as the Mormon church that sends elders to every... You know, another terrible thing the Mormons do is they urge upon every family a weekly devotional service run by the head of the family. In all the years, now for 50 years, I have been in evangelical churches that I respected and where it was blessed by. I have never heard a sermon on why or how or whatever about family devotions. The Mormons have a wonderful book, big thick book, a couple of pages or 3 or 4 pages for every day of the year. And it's designed so that even little kids can participate in that service and not just have to sit quiet and be there. But of course, if the Mormons do it, we couldn't do it, right? We couldn't possibly stress a weekly devotional service in the family if they do it, because it's got to be wrong. Well, you know, here's an amazing thing. I don't think counselors or pastors can deal with many of the problems of human society. We're not set up for it. Our churches are now urbanized so that nobody really knows each other very well. We're not going back into the same village or town that we came from, so that the truth on Sunday is applied by and held accountable by the same people all through the week. I remember years and years ago saying to myself, churches can't help drunks, not real true alcoholics. We're an outpatient clinic structure, aren't we? We help people if they come, but if they don't come, you know, we can't go after them. People can't come here and say, here, we'll take you in for 24 hours or 36 hours. We don't have that structure. And so, of course, Alcoholics Anonymous, even if you move to a different town, you can get in there. There's no two-year limit for association. It's a permanent thing. And I remember years ago saying, you know, churches aren't the right structure. They're not structured right, better said, to deal with certain kinds of problems.
Please turn the tape over now for the remainder of the message.
That comes into our staff is so protective of their family life that there's nothing left over to work with, you know. I mean, the family will take the whole thing, but they're a very imperfect, partial family at best. We used to joke in Guatemala years ago how we needed some visiting grandparents. We didn't think of it as a shouting problem, but we did notice that that was something. We were all more or less the same age. God had something better to give us than stratified classrooms and stratified workforces and outpatient clinic exhortations, as incredibly valuable and beneficial though it may be. But very, very different from churches on the mission field. In America, no one knows anybody, really. They know who they are. The name tag syndrome. I've often said, once a church begins to tell the members to wear name tags, it's already too late. But the village churches of the world have a completely different dynamic. And so we major on the crumbs of society. We major on displaced persons. We can give people in the fellowship of the church at least once a week, we can give them the semblance of a real family and love and friendly noises and goodwill, which is genuine and valuable. We can do that. But they may need a lot more than that. In fact, the great surge of attendance in America is not so much an evidence of the power of the gospel, I'm convinced, although I would not question the power of the gospel, as it is a symptom of a society breaking down. Many a missionary needs the society he goes to break down in order to build an American church. And many a missionary ends up with a congregation of what the anthropologists call the deviants of society. Because the normal families don't need what the church has to offer. It's just like in this latest leadership magazine, which we've all probably seen, there is this rather disturbing comment that people in support groups may sit in judgment on the traditional church. In their view, traditional ministries fail to meet their inner needs. The church starts to look pretty shallow to them. They've spent weeks pouring out their hearts and confessing their struggles in a small group, so they're not too impressed when they walk into a Sunday school class and hear people talking about the football game or offering prayer requests only for their Aunt Sarah's minor surgery. They tend to criticize others for their lack of depth. Now, the same exact thing could be said about a person who comes from a rich, functioning family into a church of shards, pieces of broken pottery that are assembled on Sunday with great benefit but not complete adequacy. And so churches around the world are filled with families. In fact, the ancient synagogues, as best I can understand, and therefore the churches that followed their pattern almost to a T, were set up basically around a number of extended families whose elders constituted the elders of the synagogue. And when a member of one of these families was going wrong or doing something they shouldn't, the church as a church didn't sit in judgment so much as the church, the elders as a group, would say to the elder who was in charge, "Hey, you've got to see about that." And so there was a group dynamic of elders, but each of them represented an authority structure that was more powerful, more permanent, and I believe more biblical and theologically significant than that of the church itself, because the church thus enhanced those extended families. Now, we don't have extended families. We can't build churches like that. And my problem, now that my time is gone, is that it might take too long even to describe what could be done. But I would like to say this at least before we go into questions. I think pastors are the most important people in America today. They're more important than the missionaries. They're more important than anybody else. They are, if anyone is able, they are the ones who ought to be able to do something about this incredible decline of, I'll have to say, traditional family structure. I could say biblical family structure because you see it in the Bible, but you see it outside the Bible. Just like you see breastfeeding outside the Bible. It doesn't mean it's evil just because it's outside as well as inside. And this is what gives rise to the fact that many unfinished missionaries will go to the field and be finished by pagan family structures that they witness. Now, that's a very radical statement. Just as a mother, let's say, who was taught not to nurse her baby and to feed it a bottle, might go overseas. I don't know where I would be in the world today because we've been so influential with our Nestle baby food ads and billboards all over the world. But they might somewhere in the world find someone nursing a baby and say, "Oh, is that how you do it? Or is that how it could be done?" Whether those people were Christians or not, they could learn something about the creative purpose of God. Now, this is why I feel at home in the context of this sacred place. And I think Larry was trying to say the same thing several times. Solving problems is nothing compared to discovering or rediscovering the creative purposes of God, which would do away with those problems in a more fundamental way. Otherwise, we're putting band-aids on problems that are much more serious. I remember talking to a missionary, a surgeon, who performed three gallbladder operations per day out in the Navajo Reservation. I asked him, "What is causing all this gallbladder trouble?" He says, "That's not my problem." I said, "Well, you know, it is said that these long tails of the Navajo sheep that are just pure fat, which the Navajos love, that's the source of their gallbladder problems." And he knew that much. But that's not his problem. His problem is to take the gallbladders out after they've been damaged by a structural feature of society that's been there for centuries, and which the Navajos themselves would consider totally invisible as a problem. And what could be more normal than the gaiety and the wonder and the fellowship of a social event in which the sheep's tail is prominent and which wrecks their physical inheritance? Now, these are the kinds of things that we need to talk about. I don't mean to say that counseling problems are usually superficial or band-aid problems, though probably sometimes they are. I would be more concerned to make clear my opinion that there are problems behind those problems. And I think Larry was trying to say this last night himself when he talked about the the deep down problem of the soul. And he ended up talking about primary community. Now, you know, God created a primary community, didn't he? Shouldn't we as pastors take more seriously whatever it was that God had in mind, whether it still exists or not? Can it be rebuilt? I told a man who planted 15 churches, I said to him, after listening to him talk to our staff one Thursday night afterwards, I said, you know, has it ever occurred to you to try to, instead of planting another church, plant a town? Now, in my situation, we have sort of like a little town. Everyone lives there. They work together. This is an unusual situation. It offers opportunities that we're slow in catching up to because they're not normal or common in American society. In certain parts of America, there's this sequence of events that have taken place. Companies, businesses, commercial outfits that aren't out to help people but earn money have nevertheless recognized that the women can't come to work unless somehow their kids can come with them. So they have childcare facilities. Then they still have problems getting there every day because they have older people. They discover the older people. So then they have older care facilities in the same place. Then the next stage is they realize that these older people could help them take care of the younger people. And in one huge place in Massachusetts, they have a building twice as long as this one, but not as wide. And at one end, they have certain kinds of adults and children, other end others, and some are just babies, others are older, and some adults are really can't help anybody, but most of the adults and most of the children help each other. It is called a senior care child care facility. Imagine we're reinventing the family. Now, in most of the world, as in the Baskin and Robbins ice cream office or store in South Pasadena, California, whole families work together. And I had some quotes I was going to read from a woman you need to know. Here's the Reformed Journal. Couldn't be too far off. It was in the Reformed Journal. Mary Stuart Van Leeuwen, Men, Women, and the Farm. She is saying that the absence of the wife from the home isn't the problem. It's the absence of the father from the home. And she talks about the fact that back in our history and most of the rest of the world, the father and the mother are both home. And for the father to disappear is just about as bad as for the mother to disappear. It's worse, of course, when they're both gone. Once in my whole life, at the age of 93, just a couple years ago, once in my whole life, I went to work with my father. Now, John Newton, Cooper's father, took him to work. Even though it was a lousy relationship, it might have been something. But you know, it was Newton's father, right. And I found out who my father was. Otherwise, all he was a man who came walking down the street about 5 after 5 every day. I had no idea who he was or the people that he supervised and so forth. But you see, in most of the world, children do know who their parents are. Wives do work with their husbands. They see them under pressure. They see them achieve. They see them fail. It isn't the secretary that sees them achieve and sees them fail. How many millions of men marry their secretaries because those people are closer to them than their wives? The American structure is itself a much more foundational problem, it seems to me, than the problems that surface, the symptoms of that deeper problem. Well, again, I want to stop now because there may be comments and other things. Yeah. And I can't hear very well. I had both of my eardrums rupture a while ago, and so my hearing is lousy. So he's going to be my
So if you have questions,
ears.
Just say them loudly, and then I'll restate them.
Your comments raise the question, should the world look to North America for missionary force?
Yeah, I was telling somebody in the intermission, you know, he was saying the Evangelical Free Church is trying to deal with its missionary personnel problems. And at one point he said, you know, am I right that you don't seem too concerned about this? I said, well, no, I'm just telling you that every board has these problems. You certainly ought not to try to solve them all by yourself. You know, compare notes and so forth. But I went on to say, it may very well be that God isn't going to be able to use America. We have the weirdest background you could imagine for the mission field in many, many cases, unless we go to a highly urbanized setting that's similar to our own. But there's a rising tide of missionaries from the mission field. I mean, there's a lot more Russians, and I mean Russians, who are missionaries than anybody ever knew about or could have believed, that are filtering down into those Central Asian republics. You know, the Holy Spirit wants the kingdom to come wherever he is at work. And we don't have to go and tell these people that they have something they should share. I remember an Armenian in my Sunday school class back in Pasadena, a very wealthy retired electrical contractor, the biggest in Southern California, goes back and forth to Soviet Armenia. And he was telling me how a Pentecostal pastor from what was then Leningrad, 32 years ago, decided that God wanted him to go and reach the Armenians, who are, you know, externally Christians, but don't even have a Bible practically in the Republic, and has built 1,000-member congregations down there over the last 30 years, you know. Nobody from America went out there and told him, you need to, you know, read the Great Commission twice. So all over the world this is happening. There must be 40,000 third world mission people going. So that right now, I honestly think, read the little handout there, one of the most creative and strategic things an American missionary could do would be to help third worlders be missionaries. As you know, most of our missionaries are located where, in yesterday's mission fields, where there are Christians coming out the ears, you know. And I met people whose grandfathers were Presbyterian ministers when I got to the field. Churches there before there was a single church in California. But these people may not, like we slept for 250 years after the Reformation before we discovered the Great Commission. They may be sleeping too. And yet, it is too late now. This wave, this vision has swept Latin America, it's swept Asia, it's swept Africa. There are thousands and thousands of third world missions. But they're falling all over themselves in terms of organization, training, and missiology. And American missionaries could help, I think, more strategically in that area than any other way. The question is, how could we get the mission boards to be more concerned about finding the right kind of leaders, wherever they may be found, than just simply sending Americans overseas? You know what? That's your problem. The mission boards cannot do anything else from what they're doing if the churches refuse to support anybody over there, but only will support their own people who go. I'm going. And the American church is a big problem. I'm going at 3 o'clock to talk to the pastor of a large church here in Minneapolis. There's a couple on our staff who were on their way to the mission field and came for 2 years internship. They grew into a very responsible set of positions, the two of them. The man has 47 people working for him. He's a godly, spiritually minded, intellectually alive, tremendous benefit, not just on the job, but between in our whole community. The church has written him a letter saying, we can't support you beyond June because you're not a missionary. All you're doing is making a tremendous contribution to missions. You know, they didn't add that last statement. But suppose my secretary, one of my most recent secretaries, they've just gone on to the field. I mean, they've lost the vision and gone to the field. But One of my most recent secretaries is working in London with the Kurds. And, you know, that's great. She couldn't get into the Kurdish situation in Iraq so easily, and so there she is. Well, I feel like saying, Terry, T-E-R-I, Terry, there's more Kurds in San Diego than in London. Why don't you work in San Diego? The obvious answer, no church would support her. They don't recognize what a mission field really is. And so the answer to your question and about four other major questions is that you pastors have not somehow enlightened your people as the fact that missions is not a career that certain people perform, but a cause in which all of us must be involved, in which the pastor in this country is one of the absolutely key people. A man called me up from another church. They also are going to try to cut this couple off that's been with us for two years now and are real, you know, disobeying the Lord by not becoming real missionaries. And so I said to this man, is there any way, he's the head of the mission committee, not the pastor, do you think there's any way to convince your mission committee that your contribution as a church would be greater in helping these people if they stay here than if they go? He said, well, how could you justify that? So I said to him, how can you justify the fact that you're staying home and heading up the mission committee? How can I justify the fact that I'm staying home? Don't you believe, don't I believe that what we're doing is important and that without these kinds of things in the war you have people, you know, 450 people behind every person that pulls the trigger? Can't we believe in the war effort, not just in a certain kind of a hero out there on the front line? I said, what you need to do is to convince your church that your part-time salary is justified. And when you do that, you will have convinced them that this couple is, what they're doing is justified. But this is not easy to explain. Missions has to involve cockroaches and mosquitoes and dangers and heat. And missionaries who have those advantages and in their letters can validate their true calling, you know, are just real lucky.
Tom.
Well, the question is, in a big denomination, now I'm a member of a big denomination that doesn't believe in missions. It's called the Presbyterian Church USA. And your church, in its background, has a glorious missionary tradition. So does mine. What to do about it? I'm still a member of that church because of the influence of John Wesley, who said he was going to stay in the church he was born in until they threw him out. And they haven't thrown me out yet. But meanwhile, I have helped to start renewal activities within the denomination. There are five different organizations that I've helped to start. And one of them alone, called the Presbyterian Frontier Fellowship, has its own version of the Global Prayer Digest, which you can see out here. And in the last 4 or 5 years, they've raised over $3 million that is exclusively designated for frontier mission outreach. Now, the people at the headquarters, they don't like nasty letters from pastors saying that they're liberal. They don't like nasty letters saying that we're not going to give any more money to the denomination. They apparently have no defense against somebody who comes to the door with a bag of money and says, would you be willing to spend this money in a certain way? And that is an out. At least your denomination could, I think, without reinventing the wheel, could find out how it's been done very amicably within the constitutional provisions and so forth. And it's just, the key word is pluralism. They allow for homosexuals and everybody else, and even evangelicals. And even mission-minded evangelicals. And if you can press home the the legitimacy of that type of pluralism than like a citizen of Minneapolis. The city of Minneapolis isn't doing all you want to do with your tax monies, but it's doing some of the things you want to do. And so long as you can do what needs to be done, either as a private enterprise within that city or as a formal part of the city government, one way or another, there's tremendous opportunity still. Now, the Baptist General Conference has turned a corner. But it didn't turn a corner because John said to himself, these guys aren't thinking in terms of frontiers. I'm going to join another denomination. It turned the corner because he sweated and worked with a long paper and did many, many other things he did, which I'll never know of, and sent to them and worked with them. And, you know, things changed. So I would say there certainly is reason to stick with the city of Minneapolis and even with the United States, which is a rather wretched government in some ways. If you want to know what I mean by that, we put millions of dollars of tax funds into motion pictures that promote the sale of cigarettes in unmarked packages in other countries of the world. It was Jimmy Carter who recently quoted the World Health Organization saying that we kill more people in Colombia with our cigarettes than they kill in the United States with their cocaine. This is absolutely mainstream American evil projected out upon the world. You know, the flap about the Japanese bringing all these girls over from Korea and feeding them into their armed forces. You know, here we are. Oh, isn't that terrible? What about these great big battleship cruisers come into Pattaya, Thailand, and unleash 3,000-4,000 men, with, of course, advance notice so the governments can scrounge up girls from all over the country, you know. The government gets $11 million out of 11 days, and hundreds of thousands of girls are involved. This is the United States of America in its most official stationery. And, you know, the scholar in Japan who rummaged around and found that actually the military really did order something about this, you know, and got the goods on the government. And then the phone line brought in a bunch of 60 and 70-year-olds who said, yeah, it's really true. This is true, you know. And then the whole country reels and confesses that maybe it was really true. We haven't confessed. You know, we could find 1,000 pages of documents for everyone that they could find. You know, this is not lost on the mission field. Missionaries are in a terrible position to preach the gospel when this is the result of the gospel, you know, in our own land.
Okay, one more question. Sure, go ahead.
Yes.
I guess I don't know of anything more basic that we could deal with than the covenant the family covenant that we have been given in the Bible, that is the most precious thing we've ever lost in the history of Christianity. And, you know, it wasn't really an evil thing we did. I mean, we didn't think we were going wrong when we urbanized and industrialized and schoolized and so forth. These are not evil things in themselves, but they were a trap. It was a primrose path. And I think about now, we can expect strong Christian leaders from strong Christian families around the world to help us. I remember a couple at a table, maybe it was in this church, teaching perspectives one time, and they were both from India. And they smiled and they said, ours was an arranged marriage, you know. They were just radiantly blessed as a couple. Most marriages in this world are arranged. The trouble with a marriage which was contracted by the members is that anything goes wrong, they weren't too sure when they were married that this was the best thing. Was anybody? And so if anything goes wrong, they can't rely on their parents' judgment that it's going to work out, because they were the ones who thought it was a good idea. Maybe we were wrong. Our marriages are the most unstable on the face of the earth. No country anywhere near our size has remotely the divorce rate that we have, or the crime rate. 22 times as many people behind bars as in Germany and in many other countries. Missionaries go out with the gospel to preach to sinners who live in virtually crimeless societies by comparison to ours. You know, it is really shaking. And yet, on the other hand, just because we have all these problems, we are agonized and brought back to the Word and to the Lord and to prayer like nothing else. I mean, we're forced, our faces are forced to prayer because of these problems. And maybe we can help, because all over the world, they too are following our lead. They've not only stopped using the breast in Singapore, but their urbanization and schoolization and all these other evils are descending on the whole world. So we, having wrecked the world and having lived through it somehow here, we might ultimately be the best missionaries to those similarly urbanized populations of the world. But as for other ways to fix America, you know, frankly, this is a little bit out of my line. I really don't know how to fix America. But look, if anyone could do it, it's the pastors of America. That I believe.
Thank you for listening to this message from Desiring God, the ministry of John Piper, pastor for preaching at Bethlehem Baptist Church in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Feel free to make copies of this message for others, but please do not charge for those copies or alter the content in any way without permission. We invite you to visit Desiring God online at www.desiringgod.org, where you'll find hundreds of sermons, articles, radio broadcasts, and more, all available to you at no charge. Our online bookstore carries all of Pastor John's books, audio, and video resources, and you can also stay up to date on what's new at Desiring God. Again, our website is www.desiringgod.org, or call us toll-free at 1-888-346-4700. Our mailing address is Desiring God, 2601 East Franklin Avenue, Minneapolis, Minnesota, 55406. Desiring God exists to help you make God your treasure, because God is most glorified in us when we are most satisfied in Him.